Welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, a potpourri of history, snacks for the mind, and interviews. I am Steve Heimel, sitting in for Sandy Harper and Dick Reichman, and the reason for that is that Dick Reichman is sitting across from me because he's the playwright of The Big One. The Big One opens on the 11th of September at Cyrano's, and Richard, welcome to the show on the other side of the mic.
Well, thank you very much.
So, The Big One is about The Big One. What is The Big One?
Well, The Big One, of course, is the Exxon Valdez oil spill. But it's an interesting genesis for this play. I lived in Valdez during the spill, and I had a wonderful perspective on the spill. I was working in a bar, which was the recipient of all the people who came to work the spill. And at the time, I wrote a comic melodrama, which we did in the community theater in Valdez. It was lots of fun. It was called Tanker on the Rocks. It had lots of lines like that. You know, it was one of those things.
And then it was probably kind of a pressure valve for the community in a way.
It was kind of fun. The idea was that there was this huge fish spill, and that the oil workers couldn't work out there because the fish fill was so toxic and disgusting that it ruined the oil business. So we worked.
All right. But, so tell me, is this one a farce or what?
No. Actually, I put
how
it back
can you
in my
not
mind at
do the
time.
Exxon Valdez oil spill as a farce?
Well, I was interested in writing a play first about my experience as a bartender. And all the people I met, all the wonderful characters, and all the stories I heard. And it turned into kind of a farce again. And I didn't really want it to be a farce. I really wanted to tell the human story of people who are involved in an industrial disaster. And this interest actually came to me because I was on the street in Valdez the day after the spill, or second day after the spill, and some crew member came up to me who knew me and said, "Funny that this spill should happen to Joe Hazelwood because he's the best captain in the fleet." And at that time, I thought, what an interesting story.
That's not how the public perceives him. Did you ever serve liquor as a bartender to Joe Hazelwood?
I don't know. I don't know because we had crews in the bars and I did not know them. So if he came in the bar, and he may have on some occasion, I have no idea.
Well, regardless, you chose to portray him in this play, The Big One, as not really as a drunk.
Well, he was, I guess, here, and I got to say, I didn't know Joe Hazelwood, so I'm just speaking from the public record and judging. He was one of these people that you might call a working alcoholic, someone who keeps his drink under control. You'll notice that after he went on trial, they were not able to convict him on alcohol impairment, though he readily admitted that he had had a drink within the six-hour period before sailing, which is a time you're supposed to stay dry. So he was upfront about that, and yet he was not impaired. And so I can only assume that he was addicted to alcohol and was one of those people, and we've all known them, who get through the days, the work day just fine. They got to be smart and energetic, I guess, to do a good job with a couple of drinks under them. And so I really think that the role of alcohol is much larger. Actually, we find out, and my experience was, everybody's drinking. Everybody is drinking. And that's, I don't know what that says about the event itself, but that was the fact of it. And there were a lot of drugs around, and people in the industry and not in the industry. In those days, it was very popular to snort cocaine, and of course, it's always popular to smoke marijuana. And in this industry, which had long shifts, long lonely tours of duty, there was a lot of abuse of substances, and that goes with the territory. And
right.
I think so that we bring it up in the play as if to say, well, this is ubiquitous. This is everywhere.
This is part of the matrix in which this event takes place.
Yeah.
And maybe the essence of it is that there's no real villain in your play.
Well, that's what I discovered when reading about the spill and watching the spill. You know, I'd meet these guys from Exxon, and they were nice guys. They're trying to do a decent job. I meet the people from Alyeska. I knew the people from Alyeska because I lived in town. They were good people. They really wanted to do a good job. I heard about Hazelwood. Another major character in the play is Frank Iorossi, who was the guy who came up to be the first spokesman for Exxon. I read about him. A knowledgeable, skilled guy in what he did. So all these people trying to do a good job, and That's interesting.
Well, you know, there are some people who are going to vastly differ with you on these characters, because it's simply not how it's not how the story has gone up till now. In a way, you're trying to rewrite the story.
Well, I'm not,
I mean, this is Skipper, the tanker on the rocks.
I'm not saying that the guy should have been drinking. I'm not saying it was good to drink. What I'm saying is that we have an industrial disaster. When we say the cause was some guy having too much to drink, or somebody who didn't go to school long enough to learn his job, and all we have to do is fix the education of certain people or fix his drinking, we overlook the cascade of causes behind any industrial accident. There's going to be 1,000 reasons. Ships in those days were undermined because oil prices were low. Many cost-cutting measures, both on Alyeska and the Coast Guard, everybody, the state, cost-cutting on their surveillance of the industry. All these cost-cutting measures, you put them all together, you see this pattern. For example, the Coast Guard was redesigning their radar system, and they had a cheaper system that was not as well able to see Bligh Reef. At the same time, the pilots who were the special pilots who were to guide the captains, the shipmasters through the sound, supposed to go out to Hitchinbrook all the way, they started taking them off about halfway out, ironically right before Bligh Reef. You look into it, you find 1,000 reasons why. Cost-cutting, laziness, people not caring, people doing a job too long and getting sloppy. There's so many, many little reasons that if we blame one person and say goodbye, we miss the opportunity to find the real cause of, I would guess, most major industrial accidents, which is laxity and cost-cutting and doing a job too long and taking things for granted.
Well,
those
now
are the
that
real
would,
problems.
That would make a hell of a boring play.
But it would make a better fix for industrial disasters, you know.
Okay, so you were telling me that essentially Joe Hazelwood, maybe even Frank Iarossi, are sympathetic characters in your play.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
Well, let's call
they're not
on...
flawless. They're not flawless, but they're guys that are trying to do a good job.
Well, let's call on the people who have to carry this this play that you've written in these two roles. I guess we'll start with Steve Hunt, who plays Frank Iarossi. Of course, Frank Iarossi was the president of Exxon Shipping. His superiors make sure that he personally shows up to be held accountable for this spill, and he gets up in front of the public and says, "By golly, I'm going to do it." And Steve, you have the task of playing this character. Is it hard or easy for you to sympathize with him?
Well, I think it's not easy nor hard. It's a task to understand what he's doing. He does some things that I personally would not do, but that I'm an actor. I have to find those reasons for someone doing the things that he does. And in my research of the character, I'm finding out why he does the things that he does. He's coming from a different world than the world of Valdez or even the world of Alaska. He's coming from Houston. His training is in the Coast Guard and in shipping. And so he comes into a world thinking he knows the best way to do something, not knowing exactly that he is in a world that is completely different from what he's used to. So the choices he makes are based upon his what he thinks is best, and so I'm going with those choices.
Yeah, I think from my view of it, and I was there. I watched those news conferences. I got there day two. That's probably pretty accurate. He really wanted to stand before the public and be straight with them, and say, look, this is what we can do. This is what we can't do. And one thing he said over and over again was, look, I got a problem with that boat stuck on that reef. We have tides that are changing, and we have to deal with this because we could have a much worse situation on our hands.
Right. And one of the conflicts I find within the character of Iarossi is he's caught not only between the worlds of Exxon and Alaska, but also within the world of Exxon itself. Because he's being president of Exxon Shipping, he's not involved in the actual Exxon company that is more worried about the publicity of the spill. He is really concerned about taking care of the problem, taking care of the sailors on the ship, taking care of the ship. Not so much in terms of the publicity, which he gets caught up in. And I think there's a conflict there in his character dealing with the job he's trying to do, as well as his parent company, Exxon, and the publicity that they're trying to put out to the world.
Wow. Interesting. And the character of Joe Hazelwood is played by Rick Barreras. Rick, you have a little bit of a physical resemblance to Joe Hazelwood, I'd have to say. And maybe a little bit of his attitude. He was said to be a shy kind of person. You've got more hair on the top of your head than he had. Maybe you better wear a hat for this one.
Yeah. Yeah, all the photos I've been able to get of him online, I looked at him and I was like, wow. I called Dr. Dick up and I was like, you know, I kind of look like him, actually. And
but you're not so shy.
Not always. I'm a little reserved and internal sometimes, but I've seen him in the Cap, you know, and like I had talked to somebody who had known him, and she said that he always wore the Cap because he was kind of a little insecure about his baldness. I had considered shaving my head. I'm not too far to go off on the deep end on a character, but maybe I could get away with not doing that.
So here you are playing in this stage production. I understand you got a background in films?
Yeah, I've been a member of the Screen Actors Guild since 97. I joined right after doing Titanic, actually, was the last non-guild movie that I was able to work on. And that was pretty fun. That was a disaster, and seeing how we sink the ship in the foyer. And it was actually, you know, a lot of the times it was sunk. It was all a huge 90% scale model that was on a crane, a hydraulic lifted pulley system under the water. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. But most of my experience for this role mostly comes from my experience on board the USS Constellation as a very major, avid hull technician, repair individual, training repair in Damage Control Central and running drills.
You know, I think people don't realize how serious things are on a boat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all you have, really. If you're out there on it, it's all you have. So, you know, it's all head full. And you know, everything has to be done right. I remember when we were in SLEP, I actually got to the ship in Philadelphia in SLEP in 91, and they were recommissioning it for another 30 years. And when I got there, the hangar bay was pretty much ripped out. They had humongous holes in the hangar bay where they were dropping in the new steam engines because it was one of the last steam-driven carriers. And at the time, a lot of the piping was ripped out, and as it was being put back in and we were getting the integrity of the main fire main into place, we weren't really doing a whole lot of danger tagging. I mean, there was a lot of steps that were bypassed, and there were quite a few accidents electronically and flood-wise because of it, not to mention, you know, CHT and sewage, which was one of my main focuses, was sewage on board the carrier. So then when we got it sailed, the people of us that were in SLEP who had seen some of the mistakes, I mean, it really got down to fine line brass tacks of, you know, get into the danger log, get your tag, fill it out, make sure it's posted in proper, you know, place and all this stuff. Because, you know, one little slip up, as we were talking earlier with some other people, one little slip up can be a major disaster very quickly.
So when you... I can tell that you can get into that head of an officer, of someone on a boat responsible for things. Some of the scenes you have to do, Joe Hazelwood is in a bar. And, of course, the mythology, which basically Dick has told us he's trying to get beyond, is that here's this drunk skipper, and that's the reason why this boat went aground. So how are you handling this issue of somebody that probably does have an alcohol issue but is at least able to appear unimpaired?
Believe it or not, it's actually not too hard for me because I come at it from the aspect of I was pretty close with my chief as well as most of the other people in my division, and he was in the military for 25 years and had already been demoted a couple times for, you know, little accidents and the way he held himself throughout his career, and it made for a much more seasoned, you know, leader in my division. And I also worked for the captain directly under the captain for CHT. So I was answering to the captain a lot and also answering to my whole technician chief. And the thing I was getting at is that a lot of times when we had time down and we were able to you know, go on shore and hang out and have fun, I mean, we were hanging out with the chief. You know, we played poker with the chief, get drunk with the chief. I mean, it was a usual regular thing. Now, the captain was a little bit more private, of course, on a carrier. You have so many individuals. He's in the main eye. So, you know, he wasn't the one that we would be getting drunk with or anything. But, you know.
How many people on a carrier?
We started out and slept with about 500 individuals.
Whoa.
And we built up to setting sail with 5,000.
See, this ship had about 20 on it?
Yeah.
The carrier is pretty much a miniature city on water.
Yeah. Well, I want to – there's a scene. I'm not going to ask you to do the scene without preparation, but I know you're rehearsing the scene. I wanted to get your thoughts on it, and Dick is the guy that wrote it. And that is a scene between Iarassi and Hazelwood, and it kind of takes place at the point where Hazelwood hasn't been arrested, and he's come to Iarassi, and he's saying, "Come on now, this is Joe." how are you going at them? What do you make of that scene?
Well, like I said, I've known a lot of individuals on my carrier as far as different leaders from different divisions. Being a hull technician on a carrier, I pretty much had the right to go anywhere and do whatever I wanted at any time. So I could go into a different division and hang out with them and watch them, you know, how they communicated. And in my particular division, we had, you know, a lieutenant, my chief, they had their little fallout, and then they'd come back together. So I saw how, you know, people in upper leadership kind of, you know, dealt with each other on a friendship level. Because, I mean, you can't really help but after many years creating a camaraderie with people that you work that closely with. And so that's the way that the scene plays it out, that these guys have been, you know, working hand in hand with each other for a while. And I just kind of, you know, played it by what I remember of the camaraderie of our, you know, warrant officers and senior chief and, you know, lieutenant of the division, et cetera, et cetera.
So I don't even know if you come back into the play. It may be your last scene. I'm not entirely sure about that. But there's this whole thing of between the two of you where come on, Frank, what do you say? You want to go out, just get a drink, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. a little drinky? Well, Frank has to say, no, that's the last thing I want. He sort of climbs it. The tension seems to build on that. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're kind of climbing up the steps. You guys are originally kind of friendly, and then you're going to have to part, and it's a sort of, you know, how are we going to part? How are we going to get apart, the two of us?
Yeah, whenever things would happen to me and other people, you know, if we were in trouble and had to go in front of the man to answer up to, you know, our actions and why something was done maybe incorrectly or whatnot, you know, the common phrase we usually had with each other was, well, at least you're still alive. You know, so I mean, I kind of feel that way because, I mean, right before this whole scene that pops up, I mean, Hazelwood is just devastated by what he's done, you know, I mean, when there's a point where he can no longer do anything. It's so out of his control. And he loves the sea so much and being brought up in the Sea Scouts and, you know, and, I mean, it's like his environment and he's just toxified it. He's just destroyed his world. And so when he comes back in to talk to Frank Iarassi, you know, his attitude is like, well, at least I'm still alive. Let me try to, you know, get through this emotionally. Let's just go have a drink. Let's forget about this for old times because we're never going to be able to do it again.
And in many ways, this scene is about both of their needs. As Hazelwood comes to Iarassi, Iarassi also has he has to go through something in this scene as well. And it's an imagined scene that happens between the two of them. But in a way, it represents something which is bigger, and that is Irasi's loss of his self-respect, his self-esteem, the loss of a perfect record of what he does so well. Everything he has done in his life is done to perfection. And here comes this person who was his friend who ruins it for him. So that's the frustration in Iarassi, that he did nothing necessarily wrong in his own eyes, and something happens to ruin his life and also ruins the relationship that they have. So there's a very strong scene between the two characters, and I think in many ways it's symbolic of the play that the two characters are coming together here not necessarily just as two characters, but two ideas of the play are coming together, and we're seeing how those two ideas are in conflict as well. It's a very powerful scene.
And you made it up, Dick.
Well, I was delighted by reading and reading more and more about these people. I must say I reached a point in reading, there's so much material out about the spill, as you well know, much of it generated by you, Steve Heimel, in the news coverage that you did in those years. But I became more and more fascinated with the people involved and began to try to imagine, you know, what is it to live in the middle of a big industrial disaster? What is it in the middle to live in the middle of a publicity machine? What's a real human story cutting through this path? And there are a lot of surprising things when you think about people thrown into. So the play was fun. And I don't know if I got everything right. You know, there was a certain point where I had to put away the newspaper articles and the books and just try to create scenes for these characters to express their existence in the middle of this industrial disaster. And I'm sure people will come see this play when we do it, and they'll say, oh, you got that all wrong. You should have called me. You know, I know much better than you, and I'm sure that's true.
Well, we did a talk of Alaska. You know, we get a call from somebody that knows Joe Hazelwood. It says, you know, his wife was pregnant at the time.
That's right.
And she miscarried later.
And I probably would have put that in the play had I known.
So I guess your emphasis, you could say that it's not a documentary, it's a docudrama.
Yeah. It's documentary in the sense that I try to follow the facts, follow the external facts, but trying to find the human reality underneath there, I think, is what's interesting. Because plays are really about people. They're not about events. So a play has to be about people, and I hope I got them right. If I got them wrong, I apologize. But I didn't mean to trash anybody or blame anybody.
I want to be there when Ricky Yacht watches this play.
I
want to be sitting next to her.
Well, she is a dear old friend. She's the only person among the major characters that I really know well.
Yeah.
And she does not know this play, and I hope that she'll see it, and I hope she doesn't mind my depiction of her. She's a major part of it.
Well, I don't know. It's been, as you and I both know, this has been really difficult for her personally to deal with. I mean, this made her into a different person.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, but she has taken up the cause. She has taken up the cause of the spill and the justice for people who got sick. She's the one who pointed out in her book. she's written two books about the spill, but especially the second book, Not One Drop, deals with the health effects on people. She notices that we are so worried about the animals getting sick, and of course there's a lot of coverage of that. We didn't pay attention to the fact that people got sick. And, of course, this is very difficult to track. Cancer comes later. The immune deficiencies that are caused by exposure to petroleum, they don't show up overnight. And all these health effects are also questionable medically. I mean, some doctors will say, oil doesn't cause that. And others will say, yes, it does. So the whole issue is really dicey. But she takes this up in her new book, Not One Drop. Very interesting to see how much health effect there was on people.
You know, I'm wondering how David Mamet lovers will react to this play. There seems to be an influence there, Dick. And you certainly use some of the same cuss words he does.
Well, there isn't a whole lot of cussing in the play, but I think that what's interesting about David Mamet, and I thought about it, when you do a play in the workplace, it's a very different sort of a theatrical thing. And I love, especially Glenn Aragon Ross, because it's in the workplace. And I realized, well, this play is in the workplace. And what that means, basically it means that unlike regular life, when we go out to dinner, socialize, visit, talk to each other on the street, there's something else going on. The job is ongoing, where we may be talking casually. And that gives it a whole different flavor. That's why social contacts that happen when we're at work are different from. So, yeah, in the sense that Mamet is writing an at-work play, I have done the same here and attempted to create that same sense of character, people, relationship, yes, but the job is always ongoing underneath.
You know, there was some talk when we talked about this on Talk of Alaska of touring the state, and you do want to tour the state with it, and it came up, well, maybe we can do a radio version of it. You know, I would...
That might be a much cheaper and more efficient way to tour the state, that's for sure.
Yeah, the sound effects alone. Easy. While we're in that, I did want to get in something about how did Buschwal is doing your stage?
Buschwal is doing the set, yeah.
Oh, my heavens. No puppets. But.
And well, actually, Buschwal has become quite a fine builder of things. I don't know. He's got a little shop at home, which has got all small, very refined tools. And actually, this is not a set. We want to be able to travel with this thing. So it's basically a build a bunch of furniture kind of set, throw it in the trunk of the car and go.
All right.
So we'll be at Cyrano's, though we will be able to do some set work at Cyrano's because we'll be playing there for three weeks, a whole bunch of performances. But the set's basically pieces of furniture that can multitask.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to approach this, but I guess we got a few minutes left, and I do want to get Steve to talk a little bit more about his character of Frank Iarossi. Your character has to go through an evolution in this play. If there's anybody that has character development, it's him.
Yes.
And as we've mentioned, this is a sympathetic portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to happen here is that the clash between him and his higher-ups is going to get worse and worse.
Right, it does. And he does go through a journey. He comes from a nice, safe place with the Exxon Corporation, president of Exxon Shipping, and then this disaster happens, which he knows cannot be fixed, but he also has as Dick has portrayed him in the play, he has a sense of value, a sense of doing what's right, knowing what's right to do, and so he's conflicted in that, and the conflict comes with the company as well. And so there are some places on his journey he goes through where he does lose his cool. Some of the language does come out there, and it's appropriate for the situation he's in. And by the end of the play, he leaves the company because of the reasons that he had to face in his battles, those reasons he had to face. And so he does go through a journey. Yes, he does.
Yeah. So how is it? You got a lot of lines in here, too.
Well, lines aren't the hard thing to memorize. It's working on the character and making sure the character relationships are developed.
Yeah. Steve is a deeply experienced actor, director, a teacher of drama. He knows a lot about this stage business.
Oh, that's good. That's good because this is a challenging part.
It is. It's a really good part. I was not here in Alaska when the spill happened, so I only heard about it from being away in the news stories. And so I've had a really good time understanding the spill from an outsider's point of view, but also it gives me a fresh perspective on the characters. I don't have the preconceived notions of these characters that some people here have, not based upon the real experiences with them. So I've tried to approach the character from an outside organic standpoint to understand who that person is.
Dick Reichman, how is it playing? You're doing directing, I understand?
Yeah, I'm directing it as well, and I have a great cast. And
that's a big cast.
And when I direct it, I think the script seems to be working. I'm not madly rewriting it as we go, so I hope I'm right.
Well, you have it seemed like the pace worked fairly nicely. There was a variance of pace that is good. And I imagine that you speed up that point. There's a point where it almost goes Keystone Copsy.
Well, it's not by design in the sense that I wanted it to go Keystone. There was so much information. There's so much to get in there. How can I slip this in? As you well know, having studied
the
news accounts of this event afterwards, there is so much. And it's so interesting. The closer you look, the more ironic everything is and more fascinating it is.
Yeah, it is. And it's crazy. It's crazy how fast you managed to move through all that. Nice job, man.
Thank you very much.
It's the big one. It opens September 11th. At Cyrano's. It may tour the state. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Dick Reichman, Rick Barreras, and Steve Hunt. Thanks, all of you.
You're welcome. Thank you.